Are you aware of the life of a man called Yerubbaal? I hope not. If you are, you can leave early. Turn with me to Judges chapter 6. Today we're going to examine the life of Yerubbaal to see what we might learn from his life and what lessons we might be able to apply in our circumstances. You know, these stories that God has written in the Bible were true. They actually happened, but they're there for our benefit. Paul tells us that all of these things that have happened in the past that God had recorded are for our instruction, our education. So, depending on the pronunciation, Yerubbaal, you might start to get a feel for who this is. He appears in Judges chapter 6. Now again, as you know, many of you are so obvious as far as your age in the church. You are the pillars that we are talking to that have been around forever. You're familiar with these things. But it doesn't hurt to remind ourselves that this period of Judges was a time in Israel where there was no king, and God would raise up a judge to help Israel. They would fall into sin. He would rise, bring a judge to the surface again. The people would repent. They would follow the judge. God would rescue them from their oppressors. And this cycle of ups and downs kept going on and on and on through the period of Judges. It is kind of the cycle of human nature, to be very honest, that we tend to sometimes ride those same cycles. Well, this is a downtime in Judges chapter 6. Israel had fallen in to the religions of the people around them. Baal worship, or Baal, as some pronounce it. The worship of Baal was one of the Canaanite gods, and they had all kinds of rituals and things that they would do. They built what they called high places, and they built what they called groves, and they had statues there made out of wood, intricate carvings in this little forested area they call a grove, and that's where worship of Baal or Baal would take place. Some say Baal was the god of thunder. He was the god of nature. There's all kinds of speculations as to what he was. The point is, he wasn't the true God. And Israel was worshiping one of the false gods. And that's when we pick up the story here in chapter 6 in verse 1. It says, "The children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Eternal." What evil did they do? They left the worship of the true God. They were enticed by these intricate and sensual ceremonies that the pagans would use to worship their gods. They felt good. It sounded good. There was good music. There was sensuality. There were banquets. And they fell into the worship of false gods. Now, again, it was a typical understanding in the ancient world that each god had authority over specific territory. And so in this case, as they were in Canaan, look, if you want to be blessed, you've got to worship the God who controls this area, the God of the Canaanites, Baal or Baal, as we typically refer to him. So that was the evil that Israel had gotten themselves involved with. And of course, when you worship in a false way, you tend to behave in a very bad way. So the Eternal, punishing them, delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. So far, they've been under the oppression of the Midianites. What would that mean? Well, that means Israel was very weak, and the Midianites could come in and do whatever they pleased because they had control over the area. And the hand, verse 2, of Midian prevailed against Israel. And because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made for themselves dens, the caves, and strongholds which are in the mountains. Why would they do that? So they could hide some of their things from the oppressors. Because what would the armies come and do? The raiding bands would come in, take their food, destroy their crops. And so they hid as much as they could in these various crags and rocks and caves. So verse 3, "It was whenever Israel had sown, Midianites would come up. There were two things going on. In the springtime, they may come and destroy the new crops, so Israel would have nothing to eat. It's a good way to keep your enemies under your heel. In the fall time, they would come and steal the harvest. And that's what we're seeing at this point. We're talking about the fall time of the year. The harvest is coming in, and the Midianites again are sending their raiding parties and their armies in to take the food that the Israelites tried to grow for themselves. So verse 3, whenever Israel had sown, Midianites would come up. Also, Amalekites and people of the east would come up against them. So you have three groups of quite different people would band together to come and put Israel to the test, would steal their things. So verse 4, then they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza, and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor donkey. So in most cases, destroy meant to take it away, take it back home. So all the work that Israel had done in the spring and into the summer and into the harvest time was then stolen by the Midianites. Now, unbeknownst to Israel, it takes a while sometimes for hard-headed people like me, or maybe not you, but hard-headed people to get the point. So year after year after year, and they can't figure out what is the problem here. Why are our enemies so strong, and why are we so weak? We're supposed to be God's people. God's supposed to take care of us in this area. And yet they were suffering. They could not yet put two and two together. Worship of Baal, leaving the worship of the true God, being oppressed by the Midianites and others. So they were confused. They would come to see. Verse 5, they would come up with their livestock and their tents, coming as numerous as locusts. Both they and their camels were without number, and they would enter the land to destroy it. Now, it's not literally that you couldn't count them, but they were so many, they just flooded over. Now, in other words, there was no way for Israel to repel them. They were just too numerous. So, verse 6, Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Eternal. They cried out to God. So finally, after 7 years of oppression, 7 years of the same thing happening over and over again, they realize we've left the true God. We've got to cry out to the true God for help and assistance. Verse 7, it came to pass when the children of Israel cried out to the Eternal because of the Midianites that the Lord sent a prophet to the children of Israel. Up to this point, they were a non-profit group. All right, that gave me 2 more minutes I can add to the sermon. So they send a prophet to Israel God sends the prophet, who said to them, thus says the Eternal God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of bondage, and I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, out of the hand of all who oppressed you, and drove them out before you and gave you their land. What's his point? Who gave you all this? And who have you rejected? Who have you left behind? Who have you forgotten? And all that you've been doing, who have you forgotten? The God who gave you all of this. So verse 10, also I said to you, I am the Eternal, your God. Not only did I give you all this stuff, I'm your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice. There was a typical approach to this day, really, that pagans tend to have. Certainly the polytheistic cultures of the ancient times had this. Your job, you had to placate the gods who controlled the various things. And that's why you gave them sacrifices. It wasn't because you loved them. It wasn't because you thought they were wonderful. But the thinking was, if you didn't give them what they wanted, if you didn't pay obeisance to these pagan gods, they would punish you. Our God is very different from that. God doesn't say, worship me, because if you don't, I'm going to beat the living daylights out of you. God desires our love and our worship. He wants us to love him. They did not obey God's voice. So that's the summary up to this point. Israel was being punished because they were not obeying God. Now, verse 11, the angel, we haven't even gotten to Yerubbaal yet. We'll get there. Now, the angel of the Eternal came and sat under the terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash, the Abiezrite. The Abiezrites were a clan of the Manassites, a subgroup of the tribe of Manasseh. So what we're looking at here is one portion, a small family, in the overall nation of Manasseh. Joash was the head of the household at this point. While his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites. So the clefts, the rocks, the dens, in this case, this lowered area, which would have been a wine press under the ground level. So if you looked out, it's this ditch in essence where he's threshing the wheat and throwing it up in the air and hoping the breeze will take the chaff away. But they're trying to do it in secret. Because if the Midianites get reports that Israel's got their harvest in, you know what's going to happen. The Midianites are going to show up and steal it all. Kill and pillage, we might say, in the area of Israel. Now, it's an interesting thing in verse 11 when it says, the angel of the Eternal. Again, the word angel can be translated just as messenger. But the translators here saw something special about this angel. So they capitalized the word messenger or angel, and we would assume that this very well could have been the one who became Jesus Christ, the messenger of Yahweh, messenger of the Eternal. So he was sitting there under this terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah, in the area of Manasseh, in the area of the family inheritance of Joash, Gideon being the son. Verse 12, and the angel of the Eternal appeared to him and said to him, the Eternal is with you, you mighty man of valor. Gideon is told, the Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor. Now, again, we can picture in our mind, how did this work? How do they know the angel of the Eternal was sitting there under the tree? How does this tie into the whole story? Is it saying, in essence, the angel or the messenger, the one who became Christ, might just sit and observe what's going on? And he comes from the tree to the wine press where Gideon is, and he makes this really unusual proclamation. Now, Gideon must have recognized this was not the typical visitor. There was something very unique and special about this. So I'm jotting down here a number of points. I've been told that every righteous sermon has 7 points, so I'll see if I can get 7 out of this. The first one comes to me here, at least things that I personally can gain out of this story. And that is this. It happens in verse 13, and that is, it is human to question God's plan and purpose. It's human to question God's plan and purpose. Now, some might say, well, you should never question God. And I think that's true. At the same time, we are humans. Has there ever been a time in your life that you, God, what are you doing? Why are you doing it this way? Or why aren't you doing it that way? It's not a sin necessarily to ask those questions. God, I don't understand why you're doing it this way. I mean, God is always right. We recognize that. But we may not understand, we may not have the capacity yet to understand why he's right, why that's the best circumstance under the situation we're dealing with. So verse 13, Gideon, after being told, the Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor, Gideon said to him in verse 13, oh my Lord, if the Eternal is with us, why then has all this happened to us? Now, pause for a second. So, first of all, Gideon didn't listen apparently very closely to what the angel said. Excuse me. He said, the Lord is with you. He didn't say the Lord was with Israel. Why wasn't God with Israel at the point? Excuse me, at that point. Well, because They were sinning. Excuse me, I'm going to get a drink here. Whatever Mr. Trabig had, he gave to me. Let's continue on. If God is really with us, then why has all this happened? And where are all his miracles, which our fathers told us about, saying, did not the Eternal bring us up from Egypt? In other words, where is he now? But now the Eternal has forsaken us and delivered us, excuse me, into the hands of the Midianites. And that certainly was true. It is human to question God's plan and purpose. It may not be the best thing, but it does happen. We all do it from time to time. When we are experiencing a trial, similar to maybe what Gideon was experiencing, when there's trouble, when there's tribulation, when there's confusion, when there's delay in answer, it can seem like God is not aware of our situation, that he's out of touch. He's not answering. And we can rest assured as we go through this story that God's plan and purpose is functioning in what may seem to us as something in the background, but it's there. God is working in our lives. He's working to bring us to his family. But it's understandable that because we lack vision, we may not see what he's doing. So it's human to question. That's not a sin of and by itself. Now, the answers that we come to can be sin. We have to be careful. But we only see partially. As Paul says, we see through a glass darkly. So we won't see always what God is up to, what he has in mind, what he has planned. So continuing on in verse 14, the Eternal turned to him and said, now again, the angel of the Eternal is now here in verse 14 called the Lord, the Eternal, the Yahweh. So again, it would seem that this angel was the one who eventually became Jesus Christ. So the Lord turned to him and said, go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you? He gives him a command. You will be the one through whom God will save Israel. So verse 15, he said to him, oh, my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, small family group, and I'm the least in my father's house. So he didn't think very highly of himself and his own abilities. Didn't think that this was possible. Again, he's questioning God's plan. You're going to use me to do this? I'm the runt of the litter, he might say today. Verse 16. And the Eternal said to him, surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man. As if it was just one person, as if it were one-on-one, hand-to-hand, you will defeat all those Midianites that gather, as if they were just one single individual. So verse 17 brings us to a second thing that we might learn. Now, you may have already jotted down other things you're learning as you go through this story once again, and that's wonderful. They may be better points than mine. That's fine. But I think, number two, for me, it is human to want God's reassurance. It's human to want God's reassurance. We know God is there. We know he's right. But don't we sometimes, as humans, need a little reassurance? And that's what Gideon actually asks for. Verse 17, then he said to him, if now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who talk to me. I just need some reassurance. We would all like to be paragons of faith. We would all like to fully and totally trust and believe God in every detail. But God understands that we tend to be weak. We tend to be doubting. And sometimes we just need a little reassurance. You might remember the story in the New Testament where the angel Gabriel comes to the priest Zacharias just before the birth of John the Baptist. And the angel says, you know, Zacharias, we hear your prayer. So Zacharias had been praying for decades for the same thing, for a child, for a son. And they say, well, we've heard your prayer. And Zacharias says, well, how do I know? How do I know? And Gabriel says, look, I am Gabriel. I stand at the right hand of God. It should be obvious. So he gave him a sign. He gave him some reassurance. Different kind, but nonetheless, very effective. After that point, Zacharias would never doubt again. 9 months later, when he can speak again, it's a totally different story. We need some reassurance from time to time. And in this case, unlike Zacharias, who kind of got a penalty for his lack of faith, he was a priest, he was serving God in the temple, he should have had that kind of faith. He should have known God would be there for miracles. Gideon, after 7 years and who knows how many generations of Baal worship, maybe we could cut him a little more slack. It's human to want God's reassurance. So he asks, show me a sign. Verse 18, do not depart from here, I pray, until I come to you and bring out my offering and set it before you. So again, it would indicate that this is God. It's Jesus Christ, the one who became Christ, because he's bringing an offering. Angels would not accept an offering if they simply were angelic beings. So bring out this offering and set it before you. And he said, I'll wait until you come back. So Gideon went in, prepared a young goat, an unleavened bread from an ephah of flour, and the meat he put in a basket. He put the broth in a pot, and he brought them out to him under the terebinth tree and presented them. So the offering would be brought out, a fire would be built, it would be offered, and then that would be either accepted or rejected. Verse 20, the angel of God said to him, take the meat and the unleavened bread and lay them on this rock and pour out the broth. And he did so. So you can picture the scene. You've got the bread or the flour, and you've got the meat, and then it's just doused with all this broth. So have you ever tried to light a fire in the midst of a puddle of water? It's impossible, right? So again, he's doing this to show who he is. Verse 21, the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand. You might better know it as a lightsaber. Because that's kind of what happens. Takes the staff that's in his hand and touched the meat and the unleavened bread. And fire rose out of the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. So just vaporized it basically with this white hot magnesium kind of fire. This pretty stunning miracle. And at that point, the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight. Other translations render that the angel of the Lord disappeared. Departed out of his sight. Now, maybe it was a slow thing. Maybe he walked away, but you get the sense that he just disappeared. And then verse 22, Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Eternal. So Gideon said, alas, O Lord God, for I have seen the angel of the Eternal face to face. In other words, he thought he would die. But the angel said to him, peace be with you. Do not fear. You shall not die. So whether as he's walking away, he calls this back or a voice comes down and he hears this, because it seems the angel has already left, but he hears this message. So he was very thankful that he was not going to die. Verse 24, so Gideon built an altar there to the Eternal and called it, the Lord is peace, or Yahweh Shalom, God of peace, or God is peace. To this day, it is still there in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. At this point, we come to our third, at least for me, again, the third lesson that I might draw out of this. Again, there's some in between there, but we have to isolate some things we'll focus on. For me, at least, this third lesson is God must be my God. God must be my God. There are lots of gods around. Israel had lots of gods at this point, unfortunately. And sometimes in our day and age, we don't think of it. Because, well, we're not a society that has lots of gods. Most of the people we come in contact with are probably Christians of some sort or another. So we don't think of having other gods. But anything that takes the place of the true God can be an idol. So God must be our God. So look in verse 25. Now it came to pass the same night that the Eternal said to him, Gideon, take your father's young bull. Bulls were very valuable. Typically be a bull with quite a number of cows that he would take care of servicing the cows to produce calves and milk and all those things, as you're well familiar. So take your father's young bull and the second bull of 7 years old. Now, again, commentators are split as to was there one bull here or was there two bulls? Most would say probably there were two bulls, but maybe just one. We'll go through the story and see what your decision might be. So, but take the bull or bulls and tear down the altar of Baal or Baal that your father has and cut down the wooden image that is beside it. Wow. They were wondering what the problem was. And here in his backyard, we might say, now again, why did Joash have this altar to Baal right there in his property? Was he forced to do that by the other members of the group, the village, the area, maybe? Nonetheless, it's striking that they couldn't figure out that we're being punished because we've got this altar right there, this grove, the wooden image, the Asherah, as technically it is in the Hebrew, this wooden image. Couldn't figure it out. In verse 26, built an altar to the Eternal your God on top of this rock. So now we understand probably why it was in this area, in Joash's backyard, because of the highest spot in the area. Again, pagans often would build their altars, their temples in the highest spot, because then that's closer to the gods. So on the top of this rock, in the proper arrangement, and take the second bull and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the image which you shall cut down. Interesting, this second bull was 7 years old. How many years had Midian oppressed them? 7 years. So was there something symbolic about that? Some would say, as they look at this and they try to compare this to pagan rituals, that this bull, this second bull, was specifically being groomed and fed and fattened for sacrifice to Baal in one of their ceremonies. So wouldn't that be the case? Wouldn't it be ironic if that were true, that this is the bull that God says, no, you don't sacrifice this to the pagan. You sacrifice this to me. Now again, if you're a worshiper of Baal, and you've been caring for this special bull for 7 years, and some guy steals it and sacrifices it to a different god, does that make you happy? Or does that make you a bit upset along the way? Well, you can understand what's going to come next. So verse 27, Gideon took men from among his servants. So again, when they say small family, they had quite a large family operation. There were many servants there in their own household. So it's not like they were paupers or something like that. They were pretty significant in the city, among the people, but they weren't the greatest of them all. Gideon took 10 men from among his servants. So he had more than 10, 15, 20, 30, we're not told, and did as the Eternal had said to him. He obeyed. But because he feared his father's household and the men of the city too much to do it by day, he did it by night. So we ask the question, is God our God? Would we have the courage to follow God the way Gideon did? Do we have that kind of courage today? Is God truly first in our lives? Are there other gods that have infringed or impinged upon our worship of the true God? How much time do we spend connecting with God? learning from God, studying His Word, fellowshipping with His people. We can judge ourselves in some ways to say, what really is our God? Where is our time and our attention? As Christ says, as we talk about in the Gospels, you know, where our treasure is, there our heart will be also. And one of the greatest treasures we are given is every minute of every day, our time. So we can judge ourselves. Is God truly our God? Could it be that on the outside we proclaim God's name, we proclaim true doctrine, but we truly have other gods that we worship? Materialism, our job, sex, money, pornography, whatever it might be that we spend our time on. Could it be that other gods have impinged upon the true God? Serving God at times will require courage. It doesn't take a lot of courage today to worship the true God. It doesn't. We're in a pretty easy time as far as those things are concerned. Most companies make accommodation for Sabbath keepers. Not all, obviously. Some areas of the country are much more difficult than others. But on the whole, we suffer very little persecution today by comparison to something like Gideon was going through. He was going to try to do his part to be worshiping God, to be obedient to God, which meant going against every single individual in the culture around him. There'll be a time when we will have to have mustered up the spiritual courage from God through His Spirit to stand against the world. It's only a matter of time, brethren, before what we teach will come to the notice of others. What we teach about morality, what we teach about sexuality, what we teach about masculinity and femininity, what is a man, what is a woman. Are these lifestyles correct? Are they in? It's only a matter of time before someone catches the fact that we don't go along with the culture around us. Persecution will come. So we'll have to be ready like Gideon was to stand up, even if it's halfway at start. And that's what he did. He did it at night because he was a little bit intimidated by it all. It's understandable. It's a tough time. But we'll have to have this kind of courage as well. God must be our God. He must be first. And we'll have to stand for that. So he did this by night. Takes these oxen, one or two, pulls down the altar, tears it apart, takes the actual wooden statue, the Asherah pole, the false god statue, we might say, chops it up into little pieces to use it as firewood. So talk about adding insult to injury. He just didn't knock it down or spray paint it, you know, Yahweh over the pole. He hacks it down, chops it in pieces, uses it for fuel to do the sacrifice of the Baal bull to the true God. Isn't that something? That's quite a bit of courage, even though it may not have been the way we would like to see it in the middle of the day and shaking his fist at the Baal worshippers. Well, that'll come later. Verse 28, when the men of the city arose early in the morning, there was the altar of Baal or Baal torn down. I mean, smashed to pieces. The wooden image that was beside it was cut down. And the second bull, which again, was this the second bull? Some commentators feel, what was the second bull in a series of sacrifices to Baal? That may have been the case as well. Hard to reconstruct exactly what was going on here. But everybody knew this was a special bull because it's called the second bull. The second bull was being offered on the altar which had been built. So at least what I picture here is the smoke from the fire of the Asherah pole that was used as fuel, and maybe some of the other trees around the area is still smoking, and there's the second bull on the altar being cooked away. They could tell that this was the case. So they said to one another, verse 29, "Who has done this thing?" Now, you can't keep this very quiet. I don't think Gideon raised his hand and said, "Hey, it was me." But one of the 10 servants who participated in this tea party, Boston Tea Party in Manasseh, somebody let the bull out of the bag and said it was Gideon. Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this. Verse 30, the men of the city said to Joash, "Bring out your son that he may die, because he has torn down the altar of Baal. So they were going to execute him for this atrocity of destroying what they had probably taken quite some time and money to build. And it says, because he has cut down the wooden image that was beside it. Now, Joash actually has some gumption here, which is kind of nice to see. But whether it was just protecting his son, or whether there's this stirring inside of him that we shouldn't have been having this altar here in the first place, and it's good that it's torn down. It's hard to say which. But nonetheless, verse 31, Joash said to all who stood against him, would you plead for Baal? Maybe not translated all that well. Other translations render it, let Baal plead for Baal. In other words, okay, he continues, would you save him? In other words, is this God so weak that you have to save the God? He kind of rubs it in. I think he does a pretty good job. Would you save him? Let the one who would plead for him to be put to death by morning. In other words, you're the guy that should be put to death. If you have to defend your God, he's a pretty weak God. Then he goes on to say, if he's a God, let him plead for himself because his altar has been torn down. In other words, if he's truly God, couldn't he easily get rid of Gideon, zap him with lightning, give him a terrible plague, choke him to death in front of us all? If this is really a God, you have to take care of him? Boy, that's a real baby God. Not much of a God at all. He's not a real God. But they were embarrassed by that, you know? He's right. So they couldn't carry through the death threat with Gideon. Therefore, on that day, he called him Yahubabel. We said earlier, do you know who Yahubabel is? It's Gideon, as you probably figured out by now. But what does Yahubabel mean? It means let Baal plead against him because he has torn down his altar. In other words, the God should be able to take care of the person who destroyed his altar. Verse 33, then all the Midianites, Amalekites, people of the east gathered together. They crossed over. They would have to cross over the Jordan to come to the land of Israel. They crossed over and encamped in the valley of Jezreel. But the Spirit of the Eternal came upon Gideon, and he blew the trumpet, and the Avisarites gathered behind him. So his clan rallies behind Gideon. Somebody finally showed some gumption and some spiritual strength to stand up against Baal, to stand up for God, and it rallied the people. That was a great sign. Verse 35, he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, who also gathered behind him. They were all inspired by this. He also sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they came up to meet him. So the whole northern quadrant of the 10 tribes then were called into action, and they all responded. So let's get the Midianites kicked out and get this taken care of once and for all. And then I look at verse 36, and I come to another point that I think I can learn from Yahubabel, and that is God is gracious and patient. God is gracious and patient. I mean, Gideon has done some pretty impressive things at this point. He's torn down the altar. He's chopped up the pole. He's burned it to smithereens. He's set up an altar to God. He killed their bull to the true God. I mean, this takes a lot of courage. And he gets here and says, I'm not so sure. So he's human. He's like me. He's like you, maybe. That sometimes we feel pretty spiritually strong and we're going to stand up, and other times it's just not quite there the way we'd hope it to be. But God, thankfully, is very gracious, is very patient. So after rallying all the troops of the whole northern section of Israel, ready for battle, he has some doubts. So Gideon said to God, verse 36, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, in other words, if that's really your plan, you told me that through the angel, I'm not quite convinced. I hope it's true. Verse 37. Look, I shall put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only, and it's dry on all the ground around, then I know. Then shall I know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said. I can be confident of that. So God could have said, look, I already told you. Slap him upside the head, you know, silly boy. I told you this already. But he didn't. Very, very graciously, very kindly, very patiently. I'm thankful God is so patient and gracious with me. Verse 38, and it was so. When he rose early the next morning and squeezed the fleece together, he wrung the dew out of the fleece, a bowl full of water. So God did exactly what the ground all around was dry, but the fleece was wet. Now Gideon had a boost at that point, no doubt. And then he thought about it maybe a little more. I thought, you know, the wool could kind of be like a sponge. So maybe there was dew all over the place, but the fleece just kind of soaked it up. So maybe it wasn't really a miracle at all. Have you ever had a situation in your life like that? There was a miracle and you kind of wonder later, was that really? Or somebody tells you, well, that's just happenstance. Just coincidence that it happened that way. You're making this up. You think God intervened. That was just happenstance, just circumstance. It wasn't God's hand. True Christians can look back in their lives and see God's hand quite often in things. But there's always that doubt that, was that really God, or was it my effort, or was it someone else's help? Gideon had that kind of question at this point. So Gideon said to God, don't be angry with me, but let me speak just once more. Let me test, I pray, just once more with the fleece. God is gracious, God is patient, and told you the first time, did the fleece thing. Now it's a slap upside the head. Now, God, one more time. I understand how humans are. We're weak sometimes, and that's what happened here. Let me speak once more. Let me test, I pray, just once more with the fleece. Now let it be dry only on the fleece, but all the ground around let it be dew. In other words, then we'll know. If the fleece is dry, then it wasn't a sponge. It didn't soak up all the water from all around. This would be the true miracle. Now, it was a miracle before, but verse 40, God did so that night. Very patient, very kind. It was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew on all the ground. Now, any of you who've left out, let's say, a cloth of some sort overnight, you know what happens. Shortly after sunset, it starts to get damp. It just attracts things. I mean, you can have things on the concrete, and the concrete will be dry, and the cloth will absorb moisture from the air. And now he knew, because there was no moisture on this fleece, that this truly was God's visit, and God had given him the message, and they would receive the benefit that they asked for. Sometimes we question whether God is really directing us. And the events that we see in our lives, we can question whether or not God was really involved with those things. The people in the world see nothing but happenstance. They see nothing but chance that just happened that way. God wasn't involved with that. But we, as the people of God, see God's hand much the same way that Gideon saw God's hand. So we're thankful that God is so patient and gracious with us. And hopefully, then we become patient and gracious toward others. And I think that's God's point along the way. Chapter 7 then gives me another lesson, and that is humans tend toward pridefulness. Humans tend toward pridefulness. In other words, here was Gideon. He put out the call, gathered a huge army, 30,000 people, responded to what Gideon said. God didn't want Gideon to be prideful, didn't want to think it was all on his shoulders, all because of how great he was. Yerubbaal, that is Gideon, chapter 7, verse 1, and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the well of Harod, so that the camp of the Midianites was on the north side of them by the hill of Moreh in the valley. And the Eternal said to Gideon, The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, my own hand has saved me. In this instance, God wanted them to be perfectly clear that there's no way on earth they could save themselves. Now, again, we apply this in our generation. Sometimes do we appreciate the sacrifice of Christ and what it does for us? Or look, if I keep the Sabbath well enough, and I've kept the holidays for decades, surely I'm doing what's right. God's going to give me eternal life. And we're kidding ourselves. We're kidding ourselves. If it wasn't for the sacrifice of Christ, we'd have no hope whatsoever. So God, in this case, tells Gideon, you know, there's just too many people. If I let these 30,000 down into the camp of Midian and they win, and I give the victory, they're going to think, you know, I know these people. They're going to start thinking it's all up to them. We've been so strong. We've taken care of these Midianites, gotten rid of them. So proclaim, verse 3, in the hearing, the funny thing, proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, whoever's afraid, fearful, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead. Now, this is the part of the movie where Gideon is supposed to ride on the stallion back and forth in front of the troops and rally them and tell them how much God is going to give them the victory, and the Midianites will fall before us, and be strong, Israel, and fight for your families and fight for your land and fight for your children. And, you know, the Mel Gibson, you know, William Wallace in front of the troops kind of thing. Well, he doesn't. He gets up and makes the announcement. I don't think he was on a horse. Anybody afraid? Just go home. 2/3 of the army leave. Well, that's a pretty talented general right there. He just rallied the troops big time. 20,000 of them leave. It says, middle of verse 3, 22,000 of the people returned, and only 10,000 remained. What lesson do I get from that? Learn to speak better. No. God desires total trust. He wants us to trust him. There were too many in the army. They would have taken credit themselves. God desires our total trust. There are times in our lives that all forms of self-reliance seem to be removed from us. I think God does that at times, or allows that at times, for our benefit, so that we truly see that it is God and God alone that can save us, can change our circumstances. No matter what we do, we cannot help ourselves. We can't change the situation. God has to intervene on our behalf. And it builds our faith that God will certainly take care of us. So verse 4, the Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Wait a second, God. We went from 32,000 to 10. 2/3 of Israel are chickens. And you're saying there's still too many. So he said, bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Then it will be that of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, the same will go with you. And whomever I say, this one shall not go with you, the same shall not go. So I will weed them out for you. We got the ones that are brave enough to stay, but that's too many. We're going to cut it down even more. So he brought the people down to the water, basically tells everyone, go get a drink. And the Eternal said to Gideon, everyone who laps from the water with his tongue as a dog laps, you shall set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink. And the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink water. So they went, I guess, got down on their knees, stuck their face in the water, sucked up as much as they could. Now, again, if you're talking soldiering, it's not a particularly wise thing to do. Because if your face is down in the water and your backside sticking up toward the bank, what can an enemy do? Cut you off pretty quick is the point. So these are the ones who lapped the water, picked it up with their hands and drank and stayed alert, apparently. Now, the sad thing is there was only 300 of those out of 10,000. These were farmers. They weren't necessarily professional soldiers. So you can understand they weren't perfect in their military strategy. So the Lord said to Gideon, by 300 men who lapped, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand. Let all the other people go, every man to his place. Go back to your tents. So the people took provisions and their trumpets in their hands. And again, the word trumpets throughout this section is the Hebrew word shofar, the ram's horn. That will be significant as we go along. They took provision and their trumpets in their hands, and he sent away all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, and retained those 300 men who would be facing thousands down in the camp of Midian below him in the valley. Now, militarily, this strategy doesn't make a lot of sense. Pare your army down until there's no way they can win without God's direct intervention. But that's what God was trying to accomplish. Teach them a very important lesson. It happened on the same night that the Eternal said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have delivered it into your hands. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Purah, your servant, and you shall hear what they say. Now again, given what you know about Gideon to this point, do you think he was afraid? If it was me, I'd be shaking in my boots. I mean, 300 people, God, I don't know what you're doing here. I like the odds with 32,000 a little bit better than, you know, zero to a billion. You know, I kind of like those odds better. So now's the time to go. If you can't yet, and again, God showing very patient, very kind. If you're afraid, go down to the camp with your servant, and you shall hear, verse 11, what they say. Afterward, your hands shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. So he went down with Purah. What it doesn't say, yeah, he was afraid. That's why he took his servant. I just need one more reassurance. I need one more time to build his courage, and that's okay. So he went down with Purah, his servant, to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. So these outer guard areas. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east, probably several tribes, but at least three separate groups. And the people of the east probably had a number of subgroups within them, were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number, and as the sand by the seashore in the multitude. It's like taking up a handful of sand. There's no way you can count all those grains. So there were so many camels, so many people. Verse 13, and when Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. So it took some courage, of course, to get fairly close. And again, in certain situations, it might not have been unusual to get this close because this was a composite of several different tribes and groups, so you wouldn't always know who was yours and who wasn't, but an individual walking in wouldn't be necessarily a problem. But nonetheless, some way they're able to overhear this conversation. And he says to his friend, verse 13, I have had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian. Now, to me, that's not a particularly frightening thing. I was attacked by a loaf of bread. So I wonder if God didn't make this almost ludicrous to help Gideon understand, you got these people and they're afraid of bread. Do you think you're going to have a problem with them if they're scared of bread? Maybe that's what God had in mind. At least my twisted sense of humor looks at it that way. To my surprise, a barley loaf tumbled into the camp of Midian. It became a tent, and it came to a tent, I should say, and struck it so that it fell and overturned, and the tent collapsed. So this giant loaf of bread comes rolling down. Have you any of you had a dream about bread attacking you? Okay, no one here. Had other things attack me in dreams, but not bread. But the point is, Gideon gets the message. God gave this dream to this man, has him tell it at the exact perfect time while Gideon's there overlooking the area. And he said, this barley bread just crushed. Now again, Gideon may have seen a lot of symbolism here that we don't. Barley was the bread of the poor. The Israelites were poor right now. They were destitute. And it's a barley loaf that crushes Midian, destroys the tent. Maybe he saw things in this analogy this dream that we might not see quite in the same way. The point was, Israel was the barley bread. Midians were in the tent, and the barley bread destroyed them. So verse 14, then his companion answered and said, "This is nothing else but the sword of Gideon." This is the individual talking to he said, "Well, let me interpret this dream for you. This is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. Into his hand, God has delivered Midian and the whole camp." So you've got one having the dream, the other interprets it. Gideon overhears this and is elated by it, as you might be as well. Verse 15, "And so it was when Gideon heard of the telling of the dream and its interpretation that he worshiped." He realized he had been probably pretty faithless in some respects, a little weak. So he worships God right at that point, probably praying as he was crouching, listening to this story. Rest of verse 15, he returned to the camp of Israel and said, "Arise, for the Eternal has delivered the camp of Midian into your hand." So rather than waiting, God said, "Look, tonight's the night. If you don't have the courage, go down and listen, then you'll have courage." He comes back, he organizes everyone right on the spot. So we might learn another lesson as we go through the rest of the story. And it does happen to be the seventh one I jotted down. So this must be a perfect sermon. But God often acts in unpredictable ways, does he not? God often acts in unpredictable ways. First, he gives a dream about a loaf of bread killing people. That's kind of unusual. But then 300 instead of 32,000? Not what I would expect God to do. Verse 16, Gideon divides the 300 men into three companies. Now, I'm not a math guy, but I'm going to guess there were 100 in each one. Now, there might have been one company of one and one company of one and one company of 200 and whatever the rest would be, but probably 300 in each or 100 in each group. And it says, he put a shofar into every man's hand, a trumpet, with empty pitchers and torches inside the pitchers. Now, they probably would have had their swords strapped around their waist. They might have had a spear strapped to their backpack or something like that. But both of their hands are occupied and cannot do a thing except to carry what's in the hand. So in their right hand, he says, they have their trumpet, their shofar, their curled horn. Verse 17, he said to them, "Look at me and do likewise. Watch, when I come to the edge of the camp, you shall do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then you also blow the trumpets on every side of the whole camp and say, shout out loud, the sword of the Eternal and Gideon," or "for the Eternal, for Yahweh and for Gideon." So again, picture this. You've got a ram's horn in one hand. In the other hand, you've got a torch. And the torch is almost out because it's covered by a clay pot. When I make the sound, you crack the clay pot open and the torch, what? Flares into its highest possible flare. And all of a sudden, the camp is illuminated with 300 torches. Now, again, thinking militarily, if one is going to attack at night, how do they do it? Do they all just sneak through the darkness? Well, no, these are rocks and these are crags. You're going down into the valley. So what happened? Well, the individual in front of the entire army would be the one who'd blow the horn and hold the torch. He's got the torch. The guys behind him don't have torches because they have to have swords and spears and shields in their hand. So each one of these 300 in the enemy's minds would have represented hundreds or thousands of individuals that would be following right behind. See, the man in the front with the torch weaved his way down. Every individual directly behind him followed exactly in the footsteps of the one in front of him. So that's how they did it. to attack in the dark because you can't see otherwise. But if you're following the man in front of you and they're all following, nobody falls because you're right. So as soon as this happens, the enemy thinks there are thousands and thousands of Israelites attacking us, because all around the camp, all of a sudden, there's this shouting and this screaming and these bright lights all coming in. We're under attack immediately. What a brilliant plan God gave to Gideon. So verse 19, Gideon and 100 men who were with him. Now again, that's why I thought maybe there's two other groups of 100 each as well. Gideon and 100 men who were with him came to the outpost of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. Middle watch, by the way, is probably about midnight. First watch in Hebrew reckoning started at sunset at 6 p.m. because they're near the equator. It's almost always 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. That's the 12 hours of the day, 12 hours of the night. So 6 to 9 was the first watch. 9 to midnight was the second watch. Third watch, midnight to 3 a.m. And the fourth watch from 3 a.m. until 6 in the morning, dawn time. So this is about midnight, probably, that this happens. Everybody in the camp is now asleep, except for the watchers on the edges. And that's what happens. Just as they posted the watch, so every 3 hours, typically, first watch, second watch, third watch, they were replaced. So they could go sleep and others now watch. So the new guys just got in their positions. They're not even settled yet. And they blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers that were in their hands. Then the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers that they held their torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands for blowing. And they cried, "The sword of the Eternal and of Gideon." And every man stood in his place all around the camp, and the whole army ran and cried out and fled. They hear this noise, they see this light, and they are terrified. They get up, they get under in bed, they still got their PJs on, and they're getting their swords and their spears together. They didn't have PJs, I'm just saying that. They get their things together, and they're dashing all around, and people are stumbling on top of each other, and they're people they don't recognize. They're people from the east. Are they Midianites? Are they not? It's dark. The lights are blaring everywhere. They don't know what's going on, so they end up killing each other. The entire camp starts turning on itself in this mayhem. And again, oftentimes, when people banded together to take advantage of someone else, they weren't particularly close friends. The Midianites and these people of the east were not necessarily the closest of friends. But if we can both take advantage of Israel, we combine our forces and we both get from this, it's a pretty good deal. So they're turning on each other. They don't know what happened. 300, verse 22, the 300 blew the trumpets. The Eternal set every man's sword against his companion throughout the whole camp. If you've got people running past your tent with swords, you think they're the enemy. So God caused this commotion to be where they turn on themselves. Throughout the whole camp, the army fled to Beth Acacia toward Zerah, as far as the border of Abel Moholah and by Tabith. So all these outskirt areas. And the men of Israel gathered together from Naphtali, Asher, Manasseh, and pursued the Midianites. In other words, the message goes out, come on back. The battle's over. Let's get out there and clean this up. So they all jump in at that point. Gideon sent messengers throughout all the mountains of Ephraim, verse 24, saying, come down against the Midianites and seize from them from the watering places as far as Bethbara and Jordan. And all the men of Ephraim gathered together and seized the watering places as far as Bethbara and Jordan. And they captured two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb. And they killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and they killed Zeb at the winepress of Zeb. So two of the great leaders of the Midianites were also taken in the battle. And they pursued the Midianites and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon on the other side of the Jordan. So fantastic blessing. It is often impossible to predict exactly what God will do when he rescues us. And this is in part because God is working on multiple levels all at once. You've all known situations, no doubt, where maybe a husband gets chronically ill or terribly ill or in some terrible accident. We realize God is certainly working with him, But we also realize on a totally different level, God is working with his wife or with their children or with the congregation that they attend so that they might all benefit from God's working with them to develop compassion and love and support and all those things. God can work on many levels all at once. So God here is working with all of Israel, asking them to repent. Now, I can't quit the sermon without point eight. Sorry, it's no longer a perfect sermon. But I almost feel obligated to read the first few verses, at least, of chapter 8, because I learn from this, people get offended over the strangest things. Maybe a better lesson is, don't have such a thin skin. Don't think of yourself as so important, because we're not. I can be replaced at any time. The work of God does not need me. It's God's work, not the work of men. Verse 8, chapter 8, verse 1. Now the men of Ephraim said to him, now remember when Gideon first began gathering the tribes, he stuck to the tribes that were in the far north. He had Zebulun and Naphtali, and didn't deal much with Ephraim. Didn't even call them originally just to send them back home the way he did everybody else. But when the cleanup operation came, then he calls upon Ephraim. The men of Ephraim said to him, why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went to fight with the Midianites? They're offended now because they're part of the cleanup operation. Now, that's a pretty silly thing. Just go clean it up. Take all the stuff that they've got. Now, how can you be offended at that? Have you ever seen people in the Church of God get offended over what seem to be really ridiculous things? Well, I used to be in charge of serving the chili at the chili social. But now, put one of those young girls in there. What do they know about serving chili? Well, it's not too hard. I hope and pray, now that I've just used that example, that you don't have a chili social here and the generational change has taken place in the church like it has to and we've offended somebody. If that's the case, I am truly sorry. I'll try to think of another example just as silly for others. Ever notice people get upset about the silliest things sometimes? Well, too much focus on the self, not enough on the benefit of the brethren as a whole. So they're upset about this, and it's just great to see Gideon. He's not just an oaf. He has some real talent in ameliorating the situation, to lower the level. It says they reprimanded him sharply. They were ticked off. Verse 2, so he said to them, what have I done now in comparison with you? I mean, look, you are the man, Ephraim. You are the guys. What have I done in comparison to you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage from where I come from? I mean, your leftovers are better than the very best that we have. Self-deprecating. He doesn't say, well, you arrogant Ephraimites, what in the world are you thinking? I call you down so you can have an easy take. We've already done the hard part. All you have to do is collect, and you're going to bug me about that? But he self-deprecating, he says, no, boy, where I you guys are the boss. Ephraim is at the top. I mean, we're just little Manasseh here, a small portion of Manasseh. Verse 3, God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. What was I able to do in comparison with you? So he doesn't fight them over it. He pokes a hole in that balloon and lets the air out slowly, and everything is fine. Their anger toward him subsided when he said that. He didn't let his pride get in the way. He simply realized it's not worth fighting over at this point. So an excellent example for us. Rather than appreciation and thanks, Gideon gets accused, and he simply has the skill to drain the emotion from the situation and calm it. And that's a wonderful example for us. So, brethren, I hope that the life of Yahrubabel has been helpful and useful for us. He's given us the story in the scriptures to learn from it. So let's do what we can to learn and apply the lessons we've seen today.